This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Ryan Reeves makes his way to the front of the net. Belmar, Nosek. Nosek on it on the backhand at the line for Spezza. Spezza being watched by Armia. Scores! Spezza with the wrister from the line. Ryan Reeves may have been the one to tip it in front of Connor Hellebuck. And the Vegas Golden Knights have regained the lead. It's 2-1.
With that, Ryan Reeves' goal proved to be the final goal in the Winnipeg Jets 2017-18 season. The Jets lose in the Western Conference Final 2-1. They lose in the series 4-1. And with a whimper, not a bang, the Winnipeg Jets season has come to an end this past Sunday afternoon. Good evening, universe. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by my colleague, Ezra Ginsberg. We welcome you to NHL This Week, the final NHL This Week for this 2017-18 NHL season.
The big finale.
The big season finale of NHL This Week. Don't you worry, though. Saturday's Illegal Curve Hockey Show will continue going strong all throughout the summer, keeping you up to date on everything to do with the Winnipeg Jets.
It's been a long year, Drew. I've spent enough time with you.
I've spent more than enough time with you. I would have said that even before the season started, I would have said I've spent more than enough time with you. But alas, the season did come to an end for the Winnipeg Jets on Sunday. Ezra, certainly a disappointing end to the season, given how the series started only, say 8 days ago, 10 days ago now, when the Jets won that game one at home against the Vegas Golden Knights quite handily. And people thought that the Golden Knights were going to be maybe a bit of a speed bump on the way to the Stanley Cup final. They certainly turned out to be way more than a speed bump, and the Winnipeg Jets were not able to recapture the magic of Game 1. They were not able to recapture the magic of the first two rounds against the Minnesota Wild or the Nashville Predators. And the Jets went into a bad time to certainly have their worst spurt of hockey in the year, losing 4 straight to the Vegas Golden Knights and dropping the Western Conference Final in 5.
Yeah, Drew, I thought it was going to be a short series, but I thought it was going to be the Jets in 5. But before we get to the series and break down those 5,
yeah,
let's just talk about how great of a year that was for the Winnipeg Jets, winning 52 games during the regular season, finishing 2nd overall, not only in the Western Conference, but in the league as a whole, 3 behind the Nashville Predators, having the best home record in the league. Patrick Laine, 44 goals. Blake Wheeler, almost a finalist for the Hart Trophy. Connor Hellebuck, a finalist for the Vezina Trophy.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt, Drew, this was the best year in Jets 2.0 history. And it was the regular season, and the way they dispatched the Nashville Predators in 7, mm-hmm. the President's Trophy winning Nashville Predators. So right off the bat, hats off to the Jets for an excellent season and obviously an incredible playoff run for the fans. But it falls short this year. But, a year in which the Jets' goal was to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
They did that, and they exceeded expectations all year long. I don't think anybody was expecting the Jets to compete for the President's Trophy, to have the best home record in the league. I don't think many people were expecting Connor Hellebuck to even be the number one goalie at the start of the season after they brought in Steve Mason. But the fact that they were 3 away from going to the Stanley Cup final, this season was an ultimate success, even though you would ask the players and they would tell you that they still fell short and they wanted to go all the way to the Stanley Cup final.
Well, isn't that the rub of the whole thing, though, is that, people are on Sunday, and maybe now, that's 3 days later, the disappointment has dissipated. But on Sunday and on Monday, holiday Monday, people were all about the disappointment and how disappointed they were. And it's sort of funny how expectations change, because at the beginning of the year, way back in October, if you'd said that, the Jets are going to make the playoffs, like you just said, they're going to win 2, and then they're going to lose in the Western Conference Final, people would have said, that's terrific, what an outstanding season. It's just the manner in which expectations had been raised up, the manner in which the Jets had defeated the Nashville Predators, the manner in which the Jets were, had the best regular season record of all the team of the final 4 teams in the Western, in the Stanley Cup playoffs, that when they went out in 5, and when they went out you know, somewhat meekly to the Vegas Golden Knights, that there was the feeling of disappointment, at least in the immediacy of the defeat. So it's both a successful year and then at the same time a disappointing result, which is, you know, sort of what comes with expectations and why expectations are such a heavy thing to have on the shoulders of a hockey team.
Yeah, I agree with that, Drew. You know, after the game Sunday afternoon, not only were the players disappointed, you had an entire city and Jets fans everywhere super disappointed. But, you know, nobody expected this series to be won by Vegas in five games. And, you know, you look at the last couple of games, they were both one-goal games. I think all of the games were close. And we talked about it on Saturday's show when we were previewing Game 5. Mm-hmm. I mean, this series easily could have been tied after four games, let alone the Jets maybe being up 3-1 after four games. Sure. I mean, it was that close. Marc-Andre Fleury was excellent, especially in those two games in Vegas, games 3 and 4, and he puts up a .934 save percentage. He has one bad game. The only bad game that he had
first
was in
game one,
yeah, when the Jets scored three goals in the first period, and they won 4-1. Sorry, 4-2. Vegas added a late goal there. But really, Marc-Andre Fleury was the story. He really was. And it wasn't just Marc-Andre Fleury, because if you look at this series at a macro level, the Jets scored 10 goals in five games.
Mm-hmm.
Half of those goals come from Mark Scheifele and Patrick Laine. Scheifele had three, Laine had two.
Mm-hmm.
And we could go up and down the list, the guys that didn't score any goals, right? Nikolai Ehlers didn't score any goals. Brian Little didn't score any goals.
Matthew Perreault
didn't score any goals. The Jets didn't get secondary scoring, but they also didn't get primary scoring.
The offense dried up at a terrible time, partly because, or no, not partly, to a significant portion because of Marc-Andre Fleury.
Paul Stastny didn't have any goals in this series. He had five goals in the first two rounds.
The Marc-Andre Fleury was outstanding in the first, you know, in games 2, 3, and 4 in the series.
Stastny had six goals in the first two rounds.
I thought by game five, though, I thought Sunday afternoon's game five, the Jets just looked like they had nothing left in the tank. Sure, Josh Morrissey tied the game, but really, aside from that, after Ryan Reeves scored on the double deflection to make it 2-1 for Vegas, that pushback by the Jets, sure, they tried, and sure, it just didn't seem like at any point in time it was really threatening. And, you know, after the final buzzer sounded and, you know, Connor Hellebuyck was, you know, consoling some of his teammates who were just, you know, on their knees on the ice because trying to gather their breath, it just seemed like the Jets had nothing left in the tank. They had no more push to give. And I don't know if that's a function of the disappointment in Game 3 and Game 4 playing so hard, and then Game 5, the Golden Knights getting that, you know, the goal late in the game or in the third period to take the lead. But that sort of final finishing push by the Jets to try and tie the game, I thought, was missing. And I think that's emblematic of the fact the team had just used up all of its energy in the seven-game series against the Nashville Predators and in the first four games of this series against the Vegas Golden Knights.
Yeah, Drew, I think it's more of a function of the seven-game series against Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you defeat Nashville. And going back to what you said at the beginning of the show, that's why I think the Jets were the big favorite, even though Vegas swept L.A. in the first round and they defeated the Sharks in six games.
Mm-hmm.
It was because of the Jets slaying the Dragon, right?
Sure.
Now you beat Nashville, the team that went all the way to the Stanley Cup final last year.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're the favorite because, as you mentioned, you know, you have the most points. You were second overall in the West, second overall in the NHL, and they were flying. And they were averaging, 4.5 goals a game against the Predators, right? And that's why it was so surprising that the goals dried up. And, of course, that's a function of how well Marc-Andre Fleury played. But it's also the Jets didn't play as well as they did in the previous two rounds. And you got to give Vegas credit.
Yeah.
Guys like Ryan Reeves, guys like Thomas Tatar, Thomas Nosek, they chipped in. They contributed offensively, and they got the job done. And it was their combination of speed and their aggressive pressure, their aggressive forecheck, mm-hmm. that was really too much for the Jets.
Well, the areas where people in the, you know, before the series started, areas where the Jets would have thought to have had an advantage, maybe being able to exploit some of the lack of depth in the Golden Knights forward lines, the Jets weren't able to do that. You know, like you said, Ryan Reeves, if you had said before the series Ryan Reeves is going to be a key contributing factor, or Thomas Noshek is going to get a big goal, or, you know, or Pierre-Edward Belmar is going to be a significant contributor, you would have thought that you're crazy. That, you know, if those guys are playing key minutes for the Golden Knights, the Jets are going to be in a good position. the Jets just, you know, I was surprised that the physicality of that line of Ryan Reeves really seemed to take a lot out of the Jets, and they had no answer for a lot of the Golden Knights players through the five games of the series.
And Drew, you could go back year after year and series after series, and you could look at the winning team and you could say, oh, well, they got goals from the second line, they got goals from the third line. But really, that was the story in addition to how well Fleury played.
Yeah, they got goals from unexpected. I mean, you knew that.
That second line was excellent.
Neil, Eakin, I mean, you would have thought that Marchessault, Smith,
well,
and Carlson.
Eakin on the third line.
Pardon me, but Eakin was good in
James
the series.
James Neal,
also,
Eric Halla, Alex Tuch.
That's right.
Alex Tuch scores a big goal in Game 5, James Neal scores that big goal in Game 3, and the Stastny line, A Ehlers line, was just not as good as they were in the first two rounds.
The Jets weren't as sharp in this series as they had been in the first two series, and I've been thinking about it over the course of the last couple days and thinking, why weren't the Jets as sharp? Why did the Jets look so much more fatigued than the Golden Knights did? And certainly, the second round series the Jets played against the Predators was a more strenuous series.
Seven gamer.
Than the series the Golden Knights played against the Sharks. The games were more dramatic. The ups were higher.
Way more physical. Vegas has some guys that can throw the body around. Ryan Reeves, Derek Englund, they have some physical guys. James Neal, but... Yeah. Nashville was much more physical in that second round.
Well, the Predators-Jets series was an epic. It was one of those series you're going to talk about.
It was the best series so far.
By far. And it's one of those series where you're going to talk about it where people will talk about the series as one of the recent great series in the NHL history.
Well, would anybody be surprised if these two teams meet next year?
Certainly not. Nobody would bat an eye. So I got to thinking, so that series took a lot out of the Jets. And then I went back and said, all these teams played 82 games. But the 82 games in the regular season that the Jets played, I think were a lot harder than the 82 games that the Golden Knights played. And I know, here's my logic.
So I agree with that.
So the Jets play 82 games, which means they play the Predators five or six times a year. They play the Blues five or six times. You go through the teams in the Central Division.
Yeah, it's a better division.
It's a better division.
And better division.
Even the teams that didn't make the playoffs out of the Central Division. Well, the St. Louis Blues missed out in Game 82, so they were playing hard hockey and were a tough opponent to play against all the way up until Game 82. The Dallas Stars, were a playoff team or in a playoff position up until about the last maybe 3 weeks of the season. That's when their season tailed off. The Chicago Blackhawks were the only team in the Central Division that has been really out of it for the majority of the year. Whereas you contrast that to the teams that the Golden Knights had to play. Well, the Calgary Flames were out of it as of basically right after their bye week in January. The Edmonton Oilers were never a factor all season long. The Arizona Coyotes were never a factor all season long. And the Vancouver Canucks were never a factor all season long. So even the games, I just think the Golden Knights played easier games in the course of the 82-game regular season.
Because they were in an easier division.
Right. And I think it caught up to the Jets. The playoff series and the 82-game regular season caught up to the Jets in this round, and that's why they just seemed like they had nothing left in the tank to be able to push back or maybe find their game another level against the Golden Knights in this series. Like you said at the outset, though, Ezzy, if fans had been told way back in September when training camp started that the Jets are going to make it to the Western Conference Final, they would have said it's a successful year. But now, as they go forward to next season, the weight of expectations will be heavy on the Jets' shoulders for now and going forward, because lengthy playoff runs are now what people expect from this Jets team.
Drew, having said all that, if Marc-Andre Fleury doesn't play
absolutely
the way he played in those last four games, because Game 1, Fleury was not that great, and the Jets scored four goals, if he wasn't playing at that Superman Marc-Andre Fleury playoff level, I really think the series goes to seven games and the Jets can win.
Sure. If he's league average, the Jets are probably in a different ballpark right now.
Yep.
You're talking about a potential Game 6, Game 7 instead.
He was the difference.
100%. When we come back, more discussion about the Winnipeg Jets. Sounds like Toby Enstrom left yesterday with some hurt feelings. We talk about the potential end of Toby Enstrom's time on the Winnipeg Jets blue line. You're listening to NHL This Week. It's the season finale here on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Toby's a, you know, a special player in this organization, and you know, regardless of how things move forward, whether he chooses to play again and whether there's an opportunity to play here, you know, that chapter of things is still to be written. But the way Toby has sacrificed his body at different points in time, as Paul mentioned, playing with maybe multiple broken bones at a different point in time, even this year, there's a lot of selfless acts that went along the way with what he, you know, did on the ice, and all because, well, you'd hoped at one point that it would lead to the eventual success.
Winnipeg Jets general manager Kevin Cheveldayoff speaking about defenseman Tobias Enstrom. He's an unrestricted free agent now that the season has come to an end. Of course, can't be signed until July 1st by a different team. He could conceivably get a contract extension from the Jets at any point in time. Doesn't sound like that's very likely. He was upset being a scratch prior to Game 5 between the Jets and the Golden Knights. He'd been banged up. He had had some injuries. He'd played through those injuries.
Well, hold on, Drew. Let's hear what Toby Enstrom had to say yesterday.
Well, hang on. Oh, wait. Dead air. Toby, did he meet with the media once this year, I wonder? I mean, Toby Enstrom is not a guy who...
I want to say that Toby spoke to the media a couple of times maybe throughout the year.
He spoke to the media probably at the start of training camp, because most guys... But I don't know if he ever met with the media after that. I mean, he's not a guy who frequently speaks with the media.
No, he's not
in
a
general.
Vocal player.
Not a vocal player by any stretch. But I honestly don't know if he met with the media more than once or twice this season. And that doesn't bother me, because he's not obligated to meet with the media, and he's not what you would describe as one of the, you know, in the leadership of the team.
He's a quiet guy.
Quiet guy. Before we get into it, I should mention that this segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. To make an appointment to get your teeth tooting, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. So we know, at least, you know, Jeff Hamilton, Mike McIntyre, the Winnipeg Free Press, Mike going to join us at the bottom of the hour, reported that Enstrom was quite upset with being made a scratch for the Game 5 on Sunday afternoon. He left the arena quickly on Tuesday during quote-unquote garbage bag day, clean-out day, didn't meet with the media. Two-part question. One, do you think he's justified in being upset with Jets head coach Paul Maurice for not playing in that Game 5? And secondly, prior to this incident, if you would call it an incident, did you think there was any chance that the Jets were going to be bringing Toby Enstrom back next season?
I'll answer the second part of your question first, Drew.
Sure.
And, you know, the first one is obviously harder to answer. But obviously, at the beginning of the season, considering that Toby Enstrom and the whole situation with the expansion draft, he waived his no-move clause, which allowed the Jets to expose him.
Yeah.
But there was the agreement with Vegas that they weren't going to take him. They ended up taking Chris Thorburn, who obviously signed with the Blues. But at the beginning of the season, or prior to the beginning of the season, if you want to talk about, you know, July, August, September, I thought that there was a good chance that after Toby Enstrom's contract expired, because this was the final year of his contract that he signed, $5.75 million AAV, I thought there was a chance that maybe Toby Enstrom was going to come back on a 1 or 2 year deal. Now, the way things have ended here, I don't think that there's any chance. This is just my own opinion, and I'm not the only one. I don't think Toby Enstrom's coming back. And I think there's a good sign that chance the Jets bring back Joe Morrow, maybe sign him to a 1 or 2 year deal. But
Morrow's an RFA, so the Jets are, you know, assuming they make the necessary qualifying offer, and there's no reason why they wouldn't.
And I think Joe Morrow did a pretty good job there after the trade deadline and in the playoffs. And they're obviously not going to sign him to a 3 or 4 year deal, but a 1 or 2 year deal for maybe, you know, $800,000 or $900,000 a year makes sense.
Absolutely.
To be your kind of sixth, seventh defenseman. So I don't think Toby Enstrom is coming back. And I also think the Jets now have other players who have passed him on the depth chart.
Well, then let's talk about that, because I agree with you on both counts of what you said. I thought, especially up until
Sammy Niku being one of them.
Well, but
I'm not saying that Sammy Niku necessarily starts the year in the NHL, but he's not that far away. He was really good for the Moose this year.
He's certainly not that far away, but I do agree with you, Ezzy, that not even at the beginning of training camp, even towards the end of the season, or, you know, when Toby Enstrom, you know, got into the playoff games and he first started playing, and I mean, we know about the comfort level that he and Dustin Byfuglien have together, and you look at the Jets depth chart and you would say, look, Toby Enstrom is not going to do anything offensively anymore, but he still makes a nice first pass.
I got to say, Drew, I haven't been a big fan of Toby Enstrom over the last 7 years, but I actually thought he was a very steadying influence on the back end for the Jets in the playoffs. Because remember, he didn't play in the first round against the Wild.
No, he missed the last number of games. It's apparently he had a broken foot towards the end of the year and everything else.
And the ribs. And, and going back to the first part of your question, Drew, sure, I think Toby Enstrom does have a reason to be a little bit upset with Paul Maurice. He doesn't play in the first round. He had injury problems throughout the regular season, and he's had injury problems throughout his career. He wanted to play in that game. Mm-hmm. The Jets are down 3-1 in the series. He expected to play because he had played the previous four games against the Golden Knights. So, you know, does Toby Enstrom have a right to be a little bit upset about that? Yeah, this is his last year of his contract, and he doesn't know if he's coming back next year. So all of these guys... There isn't one single hockey player on this team that wouldn't play if he had the ability. So, you know, Toby Enstrom is quote-unquote healthy scratch, and Joe Morrow comes in. So I can understand if he's upset, but obviously Paul Maurice had his reasons for bringing him out of the lineup.
Certainly. I was surprised by that decision, unless it was strictly injury-related. It doesn't sound like it was strictly injury-related, because Enstrom had played through whatever was ailing him throughout the first couple rounds, or the Predator series in the first four games of the Golden Knights series. You know, I thought there was a decent chance the Jets were going to bring him back. Obviously not at $5-plus million AAV. I mean, Toby Enstrom would have, you know, is probably $1 million a year player at this stage in his career.
Sure.
Maybe $1.5 million.
To $2 million. You bring him back for maybe 1 year, maybe two. But you're not going to give him more than two.
I would have thought the Jets would have said to him, we'll give you 1 year and $1.5 million. And if you end up getting out, you know, played out of the lineup, so be it.
By the way, apparently Toby Enstrom might not be coming back to the NHL at all. I mean, you hear maybe he's going to go play in Sweden, but there's a chance that he doesn't come back to the league at all.
There's certainly a possibility. But this is a guy who's still... I mean, he's got his detractors, he's always had his detractors who said he's too small and he gets bodied off the puck too easily and you know the physical side of the game is too much for him. He's still a guy who makes a very nice first pass. He's still a guy who can skate the puck out of trouble, out of his own end. I mean, his skating hasn't diminished. I mean, maybe it's diminished a little bit, but he certainly can move the puck still. And those guys don't grow on trees. So I really would have thought the Jets would have considered bringing him back for next season, because there isn't a ready-made fill-in when it comes to, let's call your second or third pairing left side defenseman.
Well, I think that's going to be Joe Morrow, because you've got Josh Morrissey as your left side defenseman on the top pair.
Right.
Dmitry Kulikov he was your second pairing defenseman throughout the year. And sure, he had some injury problems and all of that. He comes back for game five, having not played since March.
Right. So how much?
And that to me was a very peculiar decision to put in Dmitry Kulikov when he hasn't played in what? 2.5 months?
And it's all due respect to Dmitry Kulikov, he's not an offensively inclined player either, so it's not like he's going to give a jolt to your lineup in the offensive side of things, and that's really where you've been struggling more than anything. So I thought that was a bit of a panic move by Paul Maurice, that, you know, I guess he's trying to give his team a bit of a shot in the arm, but you're putting in a guy who's not really offensively inclined. He's not really going to be at his best. You don't really notice Dmitry Kulikov in a game by game basis, and putting him into the lineup after he hasn't played in whatever it was, 78 days or something like that, to me struck as a bit of a panic move by Paul Maurice ahead of game five. You know, I think that going into next season, you mentioned Sammy Niku and he had a great year for the Moose, but you and I both don't know if he's necessarily 100% ready to step into the Jets lineup next season. So are you comfortable with a left side that is, you know, that is Morrissey, Kulikov, and Morrow? I'm not especially comfortable with that as a left side defense for next year. I have to think the Jets might be willing to explore left side defenseman market either via trade or via free agency come July 1, but even then I looked and it's pretty thin in terms of left shooting defensemen for next season. So, you know, it'll be interesting. I mean, I can't believe that what occurred with Toby Enstrom here is just going to be water under the bridge and they'd consider bringing him back. It seems like there's some acrimony there now. But prior to that acrimony, I could have easily foresaw a situation in which the Jets brought him back to the lineup.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I mentioned that, and I think even if he doesn't come back, and I don't think he is coming back, you know, Enstrom had a tremendous career with the Jets and Thrashers, because he spent 4 years with the Thrashers franchise before they came over from Winnipeg. So not to take anything away from what he did over the last 7 years, just didn't end very well.
It just didn't end very well. You're absolutely right. That's a good way of putting it. And it's a little disappointing given that he was the first player. I think Kevin Cheveldayoff alluded to it in his comments. He was the first player to sort of sign a lengthy extension with this team since coming over from Atlanta back when he signed that 5-year contract. A contract that proved to be a bad contract. But, you know, so be it. That's not the player's fault. The offensive side of his game just rapidly declined faster than anyone would have thought.
I think the contract was bad the last couple of years.
Yeah.
The first couple of years, the contract wasn't bad. So let's say maybe the first 3 years of that contract weren't bad, but his offensive totals have declined, and he's an offensive defenseman.
Well, he was when they signed the contract. I mean, you forget, you know, he had 50-point seasons with the Atlanta Thrashers right in 2010-11. He had a 51-point season. And then since then, his high mark is 33 points the first year he was here as a member of the Jets.
But, Drew, he's still been a very valuable defenseman. Just absolutely. Over the years with the emergence of Josh Morrissey and then bringing in Dmitry Kulikov, you know, he's been passed. And essentially, he was a third-pairing defenseman for the Jets this year. And, you know, you have to decide, are you going to bring back Joe Morrow and sign him to a 2-year deal, because you can probably get Morrow for less money than Enstrom. And in this situation, kind of your 6-7 defenseman, you're probably going to go with the cheaper option.
I think you're right. I'm just, if the Jets start next season, and you know how quickly we forget about the previous season, but if the Jets start next season with a left side defense of Morrissey, Kulikov, and Morrow, that gives me a little bit of pause.
Well, it's the same defense as this year, except you're replacing Enstrom with Morrow. I don't think that's that much of a downgrade.
Except how much can you trust Dmitry Kulikov to stay healthy would be what I would say in response.
Well, that's a fair point.
He's now had 2 straight years here in Winnipeg and back in Buffalo before that where he hasn't been able to stay healthy for all 82 games.
That's a fair point. The Jets might look to bring in another left-shot defenseman.
I would think so. But we have a lot of time in the offseason now to talk about that, so that'll be a topic of conversation for another day and time. When we come back, Mike McIntyre of the Winnipeg Free Press is going to join us, talk more about the Winnipeg Jets, talk more about their season, talk more about the upcoming offseason. You're listening to NHL This Week. It's our season finale. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, Wednesday evening. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You're listening to NHL This Week. You can follow us on Twitter at Legal Curve, Facebook.com/Legal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Legal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Winnipeg Free Press, he covers the Winnipeg Jets. He's a very close friend of this program. We're pleased to welcome back Mike McIntyre. Mike, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, guys. Good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure, Mike. Obviously brought you on to sort of put a bit of a bow on this Winnipeg Jets season. You know, I was talking about this with Ezzy in the first segment. It's sort of strange in that it's a season that's filled with tremendous accomplishment, but at the same time it's a season that ends with bitter disappointment, and that's sort of the irony, or that's sort of the contrast that comes with losing in the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting you've mentioned putting a bow on the season, because in seasons past I think you'd almost have to put lipstick on a pig to describe some of what the Jets had done in previous years. But you're right. And it just goes to show, guys, how expectations really have changed around here, and how they really changed within the course of this season. The Jets went from, and I think fans as well, went from just hoping this team could maybe somehow sneak into the playoffs, whether that was as a wild card or maybe get into that top three if possible, to, of course, bitter disappointment that this team just fell short of reaching the Stanley Cup Final, which of course, the Jets were favored to do when you look at what teams were left and the road to the Stanley Cup Final that lay in front of them. So, you know, things really shifted as this season went on and as the Jets kept racking up the wins. And I think the sense that we all got yesterday from locker cleanout day, there really wasn't much of a feeling of, well, that was a lot of fun and that was great. it was more like, we came up short, and there's still work to be done, and we're going to take a couple weeks to lick our wounds, I guess, and get a little bit of rest, physical and emotional and mental rest, and then get right back to it. And I think you're going to see a real focused team when they reconvene in late summer, early fall here.
Mike, you and Jeff Hamilton wrote about Toby Enstrom in yesterday's Winnipeg Free Press and how this might be the last time we see Toby Enstrom in a Winnipeg Jets uniform. If this is Toby Enstrom's last year with Winnipeg, how do you think he's going to be remembered? Because he's been here for all 7 years. And if Enstrom doesn't come back, does that open the door for Joe Morrow to be signed to a 1 or 2 year deal?
It's interesting, eh, guys? I mean, these Jets always seem to have a couple players every year that are very divisive, that either the hardcore fans either absolutely love or absolutely despise. And Toby Enstrom, I think, and the way he's sort of finishing up things here in Winnipeg, and it certainly does look like this is the end of the road for him in Winnipeg. Heck, this may be the end of the road for him in the NHL period. Even yesterday, Kevin Cheveldayoff made mention of sort of let it slip, I guess, that retirement might be a possibility. You know, talked about Enstrom, whether he even wants to continue playing. But, you know, I get the sense that there's two camps out there. There's people that feel Toby Enstrom was, even this season, a valuable member of the Jets who could do a lot of things, unheralded things, if you will. Certainly he wasn't the offensive force that he used to be, but he was still an efficient puck-moving defenseman who brought out the best in his partner, Dustin Byfuglien, who, of course, had a really good year. And then there's the camp out there, and I don't really understand these folks, you know, the good riddance people who feel that Toby Enstrom is a hindrance. Now, I will say this, it's clear, and the way this sort of is ending with Toby Enstrom, that certainly for Game 5 against Vegas, Paul Maurice thought that there were other options better than Toby Enstrom to help the Jets try and win Game 5, a must-win, because Toby Enstrom was, by all accounts, a healthy scratch. Now, he may have been battling some kind of injury. It was revealed yesterday that he had broken bones in his foot late in the season. Jeff Hamilton got from a source that he believes Toby Enstrom had a broken rib or ribs. For what it's worth, Paul Maurice denied yesterday that was the case. So, and Toby Enstrom was nowhere to be found. Most players did speak yesterday. Toby Enstrom was not, did not stick around to talk. So, you know, it seems like he's going to go very quietly into the night, and we may not hear from him. As for Joe Morrow, I mean, I think for sure Joe Morrow, he's a restricted free agent, correct? And
yeah.
I think Joe Morrow really liked the fit here in Winnipeg, and I think the Jets like what they saw from Joe Morrow. And to me, I mean, you can never have enough depth on the blue line. Joe Morrow certainly makes sense. I don't know that the Jets would want Joe Morrow to be playing 82 games next season, but certainly Joe Morrow will have, I think, an opportunity here in Winnipeg. And what does it mean for a guy like Sammy Niku as well, the AHL Defenseman of the Year? I'm not saying he makes the Jets out of training camp next year, but I suspect he'll get a long look.
Mike McIntyre, our guest on NHL this week. Mike covers the Winnipeg Jets for the Winnipeg Free Press. Mike, off-season priority, we'll quickly shift our focus to what was to what will be. Connor Hellebuyck or Jacob Trouba, would you put a priority? Would you say one is more of a priority over the other? They're both, of course, RFA now that the season has come to an end.
Well, both very important pieces, but I'd put the priority on Trouba just for this reason and this reason alone. I think what you do with Trouba is going to impact a lot of other things that you do with the Jets. Connor Hellebuck's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Connor Hellebuck's never been reported as wanting out of Winnipeg. You know, as Connor Hellebuck's never held out, but Jacob Trouba, of course, has. Yet there Jacob Trouba was yesterday, certainly saying all the right things about wanting to sign long-term, being happy here in Winnipeg. I think you have to make that decision on Trouba. You either get him signed long-term, and if he's not going to be here long-term, you got to find a way to move on, whether that means a trade or another bridge deal. But so much, guys, of the Jets' salary cap structure, not only for next season, but going forward in seasons beyond, is going to depend, I think, on what Jacob Trouba ends up doing and what they do with him. So to me, that's the main priority. But absolutely, you want to get Connor Hellebuyck locked up. coming off a Vezina Trophy nominee season, he's obviously going to be looking for some big money as well. So Kevin Cheveldayoff, not only does he have a shortened off season to work with now because the Jets went so deep, but he's got perhaps his busiest off season to work with as well.
Mike, going back to the Jets Golden Knights series and specifically Game 5 on Sunday afternoon, were you more surprised that Dmitry Kulikov went into the lineup having not played since March, or were you more surprised that Andrew Kopp came out of the lineup considering that he played all 82 regular season games and played all of the playoff games as well?
Well, I was more surprised that Dmitry Kulikov, who hadn't played a game in 2.5 months, would be thrown into such an important game and an important situation. Paul Maurice has said many times this season that he doesn't like bringing multiple guys into the lineup all at once kind of thing. And yet there he was switching out, what, 1/6 of his entire skating lineup, 3 out of 18 guys, 16%. That was a huge change. You know, the Kopp thing, I think Andrew Kopp's done some very good things on that checking line, but, you know, the Jets were certainly looking maybe for a little more offense. Joel Armia, I thought, had actually played well earlier in the Vegas series before he came out. And then Jack Roslovic looked like the one forward who still had energy to burn when many of his teammates looked tired. So I don't think you were going to take Roslovic out of the lineup. So I guess Andrew Kopp was the guy, and I know he was very disappointed based on his comments yesterday. But yeah, Dmitry Kulikov, to me, that was a real shock. Not only were you replacing a third of your blue line for Game 5 with Enstrom and Sherratt coming out, but to have one of those guys coming back in, a guy who hadn't played meaningful hockey in almost 3 months, that was a real shock.
Do you think that Paul Maurice panicked prior to Game 5? I mean, it struck me just as a bizarre move, given that, you know, Kulikov, in the best of times, is a defenseman that if he's playing at his peak, you don't really notice him because right. He's not really going to contribute much offensively.
Exactly. And he talked about wanting fresh legs. I guess he was fresh because he hadn't played in a long time. But
rusty.
What was his conditioning at, compared to what all these guys who've been playing the most important hockey that you get for 6 weeks, let alone the end of the regular season? So to just jump into that environment is tough for anybody. I'm not saying the Jets lost because of Dmitry Kulikov. I thought he actually looked fine. I don't think he made, there was one glaring error in that game in terms of a blunder by a defenseman, and that was unfortunately Josh Morrissey's early giveaway with maybe a little bit of help from Connor Hellebuck on that play. So it's not like Kulikov, made some kind of egregious play. I just was surprised that if you're looking for some fresh legs and a boost, I'm not sure you were ever going to get that from Dmitry Kulikov, certainly not coming off the very serious, what looked like a season-ending injury for him that at one point was going to need surgery, and then he put that off.
Mike McIntyre of the Winnipeg Free Press joins us. Mike, last question for you. Both Blake Wheeler and Patrick Laine are eligible for contract extensions after July 1st. Which one gets done first in your mind?
Great question. I think probably Patrick Laine, who, by the way, and you guys heard this, of course, he said that he wants to be here long term, and that's great news. I don't know that anybody suspected otherwise from Laine. He's made it pretty clear he really likes Winnipeg and likes what they have going here. Blake Wheeler, I think, is a little more complicated situation, which is why I think it might take some additional time. And I guess the big thing that we don't know the answer to, guys, is what kind of term might Blake Wheeler be looking for? Let's face it, this is probably his last big contract. Is he looking for something in Andrew Ladd territory in terms of years? The other big thing, I guess, is what is it, this rumored contract that Evander Kane's getting, 7 years?
Yeah.
$7 million a year.
It's crazy.
Not that Blake Wheeler and Evander Kane are at the same point in their career, but my goodness, that could really turn the tables on what kind of numbers get dished out this summer. So that's going to be one to watch for sure. I don't know if we're going to get a quick resolution on that, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a big extension to Patrick Laine at some point this summer.
Mike McIntyre covers the Winnipeg Jets for the Winnipeg Free Press. Mike, we've enjoyed your work all season long. We've enjoyed all of your appearances with us on the program. Thanks so much for doing it. We'll do it again real soon.
You bet, guys. Have a great summer. Take care.
Likewise, Mike. Take care. You're listening to NHL This Week. When we come back, we got more on the Winnipeg Jets. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Yeah, I haven't put a whole ton of thought in it yet. I mean, the season just ended, but I'm sure in the next week or two or a couple of days, I'll meet with my agent and we'll go over stuff and we'll see where it goes from there and let him talk to Chevy. And I'm sure something will get worked out.
Jets defenseman Jacob Trouba, as part of the end of season interviews, talking about his contract status.
Back up the dump truck full of cash.
Jacob Trouba is going to get paid. Lots of Winnipeg Jets players are going to get paid this offseason. We just touched on it a little bit with Mike McIntyre last segment. It's going to be a fascinating offseason for Kevin Cheveldayoff and how he allocates his money and how he juggles all of the different dollars and contracts and everything else that's on his plate. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment of the show brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for over 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. You know, as I was just, we just talked to Mike about it. It really is fascinating. I mean, as interesting as the RFA deals are going to be, and those are mainly the deals for Morrissey and for Hellebuck and for Trouba, and for Patrick Laine potentially because he's still a year away, but he can get signed on July 1st. You know, what a new contract for Blake Wheeler. I mean, I expect the contract for Wheeler to get done potentially this offseason after July 1st. That's when he'd be eligible to sign an extension. It's entering a fascinating time for the Winnipeg Jets, and they better hope to hell that the salary cap continues to go up. Because as long as the salary cap continues to rise,
it is going up next year,
right?
To $75 million.
Well, it's $75 million this year. We expect it to be closer to.
I think it was $75 million this year. Was it?
$75 million. Expected to be closer to $80 million next year.
There you go.
The NHLPA can automatically raise the cap by 5%.
They're probably not going to be able to re-sign all of their players, including Paul Stastny.
I think they are. I mean,
and
I think
Paul Stastny.
I think their cap crunch. I mean, right now for next season, they are going to have $54 million, if I'm not mistaken, on the books for their players. Let me pull it up on Cap Friendly right now. Next year, they currently have $54 million. On the books for 14 players. So the guys that need contracts for next year are Joel Armia, Adam Lowry, and Brandon Tanev up front. Those guys aren't going to cost them a huge amount of money. They're going to cost them anywhere between $1 million and, let's say, $3.5 million ballpark, somewhere around there. And then on the back end, it's Trouba and Morrissey who are going to get paid. And then Laine's contract kicks in the year after that. So as long as the cap continues to rise, and if the cap is going to be, you know, $80 million next year, and then it continues to rise by another minimum of 5% every year after that, because that's what the NHLPA escalator clause is. The NHLPA can activate it so their contracts go up. The salary cap rises by 5% per year. I'm less concerned with how the Jets are going to manipulate it and fit everybody under the cap going forward.
To me, Patrick Laine has to be the most interesting of all of the players. Because Jack Eichel, 2015 second overall pick, signed an 8-year, $10 million a year contract. Okay?
Yeah.
Jack Eichel scored 24 goals and 57 points in his second year. Patrick Laine just scored 44 goals in his second year. I don't see Patrick Laine signing for anything less than $8 million and probably more like $9 million a year. But could you not argue, if you're Patrick Laine's agent, that he should make $10 million a year?
Yeah, absolutely you can. I mean,
he had 44 goals in his second year versus Jack Eichel, who had 24 goals in his second year.
Yeah.
Sure, Eichel only played 61 games. I should mention that. But the fact is,
well, look at Leon Draisaitl. Leon Draisaitl had, I mean, he had 70 points in 78 games this year. Now, Leon Draisaitl's a centerman for the Edmonton Oilers, and he's getting $8.5 million a year. So the question
is, and Eichel's a center as well. So, right. I mean, we're not comparing apples to apples, but the point is, you could argue that Patrick Laine is a $9 million to $10 million a year player. He's probably going to be the hardest, I would say.
He's going to be the one that's, you know.
None of the other players are going to be easy. I mean, Connor Hellebuck, Jacob Trouba, Blake Wheeler. We talked to Mike McIntyre about it.
Yeah.
Does Blake Wheeler want a 6-year deal? Does he want a 7-year deal? I imagine the Jets would prefer to give him a 4- or 5-year deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're the Winnipeg Jets, you give, if Blake Wheeler comes to you and says, I want...
How much is Wheeler going to make on his next contract? $8 or $9 million a year?
Well,
he just had 91 points.
That's just it. I mean, if Blake Wheeler comes to Kevin Cheveldayoff and says, I only want a 4-year deal, but I want a huge dollar figure attached to that 4-year deal, $9 million a year, $10 million a year, whatever it is, Kevin Cheveldayoff will probably...
I don't know about 10.
Well, but maybe not 10, but 9. Let's say 9. Kevin Cheveldayoff will probably accept that. The problem is if Blake Wheeler comes to you and says, I want an 8-year deal with, you know, for $8.5 million a year.
And that's my point, though, Drew. If you're going to be paying Blake Wheeler $8 million a year the year after next year, and you're going to be paying Patrick Laine $8 or $9 million a year, and you're going to be paying Jacob Trouba $6 or $7 million a year, how are you going to keep Brian Little and Matthew Perreault at $5.2 million and $4.1 million respectively after next year?
Those contracts, the Little and the Perreault contracts, hang ominously, I would suggest, over the Winnipeg Jets salary structure.
That's why I don't think they're going to be able to bring back everybody next year, because you're going to have to decide which players you want to keep, because you're not going to be in a cap crunch necessarily next year, but 2 years from now.
Well, and if they choose not to, and maybe Paul Stastny doesn't come back, and I can understand why he doesn't come back, because you say, look, we performed pretty damn well all season long without Paul Stastny.
Stastny's going to want $5 to $6 million a year.
I don't think the Jets can give it to him. Because,
well, that's what I'm saying.
I agree with you.
I don't think they can bring everybody back. I think they're going to be able to bring most of the players back.
Well, if you're the Jets, you would say, you know, I'm sorry, Paul, we can't bring you back at that price tag. And you say that if you're the Jets, you say, you know, we did pretty okay for the majority of the year with Brian Little as our second line center. And maybe a guy like Jack Roslovic, who's obviously now an NHL mainstay, maybe, you know, his development continues. If you're the Jets, you'd say, well, maybe we can go out and acquire a Paul Stastny-esque kind of player at the trade deadline again next year to shore up
exactly
our center ice position, as opposed to making a long-term commitment to keeping specifically Paul Stastny on the team. You go out like the Pittsburgh Penguins did and get Derek Brassard. Now, the Brassard acquisition didn't work out for the Penguins, but every year at the trade deadline, there's always rentals that you can acquire to help shore up the middle. Because truly, the regular season, you don't need him for all 82 games. You don't need to have your peak team for all 82 games, as long as you have enough talent. And assuming the Jets would be in a position next year, right at the trade deadline, where, you know, they're a good team and they're in a solid playoff position, that's when they can acquire somebody to give them that boost to get over the hump, just like they did this year in acquiring Paul Stastny.
And what are you going to do with Tyler Myers, right? He's in the final year of his contract. His cap hit is $5.5 million a year, only making $3 million of actual money.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got Buff and Myers, a combined $13.1 million. If you put Jacob Trouba at, let's say, $6
million. Yeah, that's $19 million on your right side of your defense, which is a lot of money.
Plus, you're going to be paying Morrissey.
Yeah.
Kulikov's making $4.3 a year. I just don't think they're going to be able to bring everyone back. That's all I'm saying.
I tend to agree
with you. There's only so much money that can be thrown around by Chevy, right?
I tend to agree with you, and that's why I don't think Paul Stastny's necessarily going to be, I mean, they're going to make him an offer. I bet you they'll make him an offer, but I bet you it'll be, I don't think they're going to break the bank or kill themselves in trying to get Paul Stastny under contract.
You
got to
think, if they do sign Paul Stastny, that one of Brian Little or Matthew Perreault would be traded.
Well, but they both have no move clauses. Perreault's got a modified.
You can waive that, though.
Yeah, Perreault's got a modified no trade. Brian Little's got a no move. I mean, they're not going to all of a sudden give these out to these guys and then try and then get them to waive their clauses. I think those two signings, I think the Perreault and the Little signings look like unfortunate signings right now. The Perreault one even more than the Little one, I would suggest, because, I mean, he's very good analytically, but look how many games. There was a stretch here where he went, how many games? 17, 18 games this season without a goal? And you're paying a guy $4+ million a year for the next 3 years at that production level? Guy who's often injured as well. I mean, I like Matthew Perreault. I think he's a good player, but at that price tag, with all the other decisions that you have to make, at some point in time, something's going to give. But I think the Jets are saddled with those contracts at this point in time. I don't expect they're going to be able to extricate themselves from it. And I think maybe Kevin Cheveldayoff was a little too proactive in trying to get those guys under contract.
Right, and that goes back to my point that not only does Chevy have to sign these pending RFAs, or in Paul Stastny's case, a pending UFA,
mm-hmm.
he has to decide which players he wants to move out and free up some salary cap space.
Can you imagine if Mark Scheifele? I mean, Mark Scheifele's contract is an absolute steal.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if Mark Scheifele?
He should be making $9 million a year.
Right now, absolutely. I mean, can you imagine if if Mark Scheifele wasn't under this long-term deal right now? That'd be crazy for the Jets to have to try and balance that and figure that out. And that's the problem. I guess that's the quote-unquote problem with having such a successful team, is that the NHL punishes you for doing so well and putting together an impressive roster. That's the reality of the situation, is the Jets have done too good of a job in drafting these players and acquiring these players that the NHL now forces their hand to try and limit the success that they can have in keeping everybody together. You know, it's a detriment or a drawback to the salary cap, which is why a luxury tax is so much more appealing, in that it allows teams to keep their players together and congratulate themselves and reward them for acquiring players and building a roster that way. That being said, it'll be a very interesting offseason for the Winnipeg Jets. And, of course, we'll bring you all the latest news on our website, IllegalCurve.com, and on Saturday's Illegal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, Arthur Staple joins us. Arthur covers the New York Islanders for The Athletic in New York City. Lou Lamoriello is now the head man in New York. Talk about that. Talk about the role that Garth Snow's now going to play. And talk about the impact this is going to have on John Tavares and his long-term future with the Islanders. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast,
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. It's our final edition of NHL This Week for this season. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, of course, will be with you all summer long. So be sure to keep it tuned. Saturdays, 9 a.m. here on TSN 1290 for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment of the program is brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at ZappiaGroup.com.
Happy belated birthday to Frank. It was his birthday yesterday.
Oh, I missed that. Yep. Well, happy belated birthday to good buddy Frank Zappia, and hopefully he made himself some delicious brisket for his birthday. I don't know if you have to cook, if it's good that he'd be required to cook on his
own somebody birthday. Should be cooking for Frank.
Yeah, but he enjoys it.
Yep.
I mean, he does listen. He's a great cook. He listens to the Saturday show. He's always got something on the barbecue out at the lake. So, you know, he certainly enjoys his cooking. So maybe that's a day of pleasure for him to cook his own birthday dinner. Regardless, happy birthday, Frank Zappia. Trying to get a hold of Arthur Staple to talk about Lou Lamoriello being hired in New York as the new president of hockey operations.
Yeah, and nobody knows the Islanders better than Arthur, of course.
Yeah.
Covered the Islanders for so many years for Newsday. He's mm-hmm. been a good friend of the program for the 9 years that we've been doing the show, yeah. and he's with The Athletic now, of course. But
like everyone else,
a lot of question marks with
we
that
might
team.
We're with The Athletic now. You know, somehow all of a sudden that happened. I'm not sure when that
I didn't get a text from James Myrtle. So.
Saying that you're now with us. In any event, Lou Lamoriello, the new president of hockey operations.
That didn't take long.
It didn't take long. He left the Toronto Maple Leafs when they decided to promote Kyle Dubas to general
manager. How long
before
Mark Hunter joins him, by the way?
I would have to think it would be pretty quick. I mean, Mark Hunter, of course, has now left the Maple Leafs organization as a result of being passed over for the general manager's job in Toronto. I'll tell you what, the New York Islanders, who have been under the reign of terror of Garth Snow for the past dozen years, which is an amazing length of time in that it's been 12 years that Garth Snow has really run the Islanders and not really run them especially well. If you're the Islanders, now you have Lou Lamoriello, and you know we know how successful he's been, you know, in his time with the New Jersey Devils, of course, bringing them Stanley Cup glory. In his time with Toronto, you would say he's been successful in that he you know, was responsible, one of the key cogs responsible for putting the Maple Leafs back on an upward trajectory after so many down years. If you're an Islanders fan, this is only good news. The question, though, Ezzy, is it too little too late as it pertains to John Tavares and his pending unrestricted free agency on July 1st?
Right. You have to wonder if the Isles ownership was looking to bring in a president of hockey operations regardless of the John Tavares situation. And, you know, we talk a lot about July 1st. That's when John Tavares can sign with any other NHL team. But when you look at the situation right now with the Islanders, they missed the playoffs last year. It was a big disappointing season for the Islanders. The goaltending wasn't good. They didn't have enough secondary scoring. I mean, Tavares still had a good year. He's one of the top five centers in the league, in my opinion. But I like the move. To your point, Drew, I mean, Lou Lamoriello, you know, we thought maybe he was going to retire. He was going to kind of fade off into the sunset after the Leafs announced that Kyle Dubas was going to be the new GM. But it didn't take long for him to be hired by the Islanders. And, of course, Chris Lamoriello, his son, has the affiliation with the American Hockey League and the New York Islanders, Bridgeport,
the Sound Tigers.
Right, and Lou Lamoriello, of course, denied it after it was announced that he wouldn't be coming back as GM of the Maple Leafs. But you know, there are a lot of question marks and a lot of things to do for Lou Lamoriello and Garth Snow. It's not just John Tavares.
Mm-hmm.
What's the direction of this organization?
Well,
I mean, who are you going to bring in as your number one goaltender? Because as far as I'm concerned, Yaroslav Halak and Thomas Greiss are not good enough. They have to bring in a number one goaltender, a legitimate, bona fide number one goaltender. And I think you have to be active in the trade market and or via free agency to make your team better.
Mm-hmm. They have only four defensemen under contract for next season on NHL deals right now. I mean, you have
talk about bad contracts. I mean, I like Johnny Boychuk, but Johnny Boychuk, four more years at $6 million a year. I mean, he's not a top pairing defenseman anymore.
No, he's certainly not. I mean, it's been a lot of years since he was. I mean, he had his heyday, of course, with the Boston Bruins before becoming a member of the New York Islanders. But it's a flawed roster right now, and that's with John Tavares.
Right, and Josh Bailey had a great year, and Anders Lee had a great year, and they have some other nice pieces. Obviously, Matthew Barzal, we have to talk about him.
Well, sure.
He's going to win the Calder Trophy.
Mm-hmm.
He had an incredible rookie year. So the future is bright. I mean, they have some nice pieces there. But I've said this before. I think the Islanders, for the last two or three years, have kind of been going sideways. They're kind of a fringe playoff team.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they re-sign John Tavares, we talked about the goaltending. You have to bring in at least one or two more pieces to make this a bona fide Stanley Cup contender.
Without a doubt. You look at the roster, and, I mean, without John Tavares, they're probably the worst team in the NHL. I mean, not far.
If John Tavares doesn't come back, they probably miss the playoffs for at least 2 years.
Yeah, well,
maybe three or four.
And then the question is, what of the franchise? Because we know that they've been without a home. For a while, the Nassau County Coliseum, they're going to play a couple games there this year.
By the way, are the Islanders still paying Rick DiPietro?
I think he might even be still being... Yes, he's still on... No, I think his buyout is officially over now. But, it's just been such a... You know, I described Garth Snow's time there as a reign of terror. And it has been, because, you know, 12 years of futility with the New York Islanders is what it's been. I mean, they finally won a playoff series a couple years back, if you remember.
Yeah, but they've only won the one playoff series.
Against the
one playoff series in 12 years is not that good, Drew.
Well, okay, so let me ask you this. If you pretend you're John Tavares, does the hiring of Lou Lamoriello change anything from your perspective? Does it make the Islanders a team still really without an arena that much more desirable than, you know, really having your pick of the litter when it comes to teams on July 1st?
Well, I think it improves your team just because of his track record. I mean, Lou Lamoriello was with the Islanders, with the Devils for two decades and won three Stanley Cups with the Devils. And obviously, you know, you talked about his time with the Leafs. It was short, albeit I would say successful. And I think when you look at where the Islanders are at right now, it's a huge, huge decision they have coming up about what direction they're going to take.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, are you rebuilding? Because if you don't re-sign John Tavares, you're probably rebuilding. And we talked about, you know, they've got, you know, Ryan Pollock on the back end. We mentioned Matt Barzal. He's going to win the Calder Trophy. Josh Hosang. I mean, they've got some other good young prospects in the system. But they don't have any prospects that are going to step into the NHL next year and do what Matt Barzal did.
No. I mean, he was their great, he was their number one prospect to ready to get in. I mean, Josh Ho's saying you don't even know what you have there anymore. He's had some ups and downs with the organization. If you remember, towards the end of the regular season, he spouted off a little bit, disappointed with how his season was at the AHL level. But I mean, if you're Tavares, yeah, it's good that, you know, Garth Snow is, from, you know, all accounts, no longer in charge. But if I'm John Tavares, I'm still much more interested in what the other 30 NHL teams have to offer to me in terms of dollars and cents. I mean, the only thing the Islanders can give him is one extra year.
Right.
I mean, everyone knows what he's going to sign for. It's going to be $10 million or $10.5 million. The actual dollar figure is relatively irrelevant when you're talking about, you know, $75 million or $80 million or $85 million. I mean, whatever. It's not a huge difference. If you're Tavares, I mean, Lou Lamoriello is a nice piece, and it's certainly a better than what was there, but it's not good enough from my perspective to keep me on Long Island, especially with all the other uncertainty that still exists with the franchise. You know, why wouldn't you want to go to Dallas, or why wouldn't you want to go to the LA Kings, or why wouldn't you want to go to Vegas, which is going to have cap space?
He could go anywhere.
Toronto,
he wants.
If he wants to go home and be the conquering hero for the Maple Leafs.
There could be 10 teams after him. There could be 15 teams, Drew. I mean, the reality is Tavares is one of those generational talents. Mm-hmm. I think he's kind of wasted away a little bit.
Absolutely.
In New York. And I think if you are going to stay, Tavares is staying because he sees and he likes the direction that they're taking, right? And, you know, Lou Lamoriello and Garth Snow are able to sell him on, okay, we're going to go out and we're going to acquire, a Rick Nash or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that they're going to acquire Rick Nash, but we're going to acquire a free agent that's going to make our team significantly better. So if Tavares does decide to stay in New York, and I don't think he is, by the way, if you asked me a year ago, I thought maybe he was going to stay, but with the way things have gone this past year with New York and the island, I don't think he's going to stay. But if he does, it's going to be because Lou Lamoriello has obviously convinced him that, you know, he's willing to spend some money and make this team better.
We will find out. Arthur Staples is going to join us coming up next. We'll talk more about the Islanders and the hiring of Lou Lamoriello. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Quarter past the hour. Welcome back to NHL This Week. John Tavares, of course, the number one sought-after potential UFA on July 1st. We'll continue our discussion on his future on Long Island and the Islanders under Lou Lamoriello with Arthur Staple.
Now, let's go live on the Legal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From The Athletic in New York City, we're pleased to be joined by our good friend Arthur Staple. Arthur, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Our pleasure, Arthur. Obviously brought you on to talk about the big news in the world of the New York Islanders. That's the hiring of Lou Lamoriello. After 12 years of Garth Snow as, you know, general manager with, I think you would it would be safe to say, minimal success, why now was the time for the Islanders to make a regime change?
You know, I got the sense that principal owner Scott Malkin and his co-owner John Ledecky were certainly not happy with the way the season went, kind of from the time that they had their celebratory announcement of a planned new arena at Belmont Park Racetrack on December 20th through to the end of the season. The team just kind of fell off the map and quickly out of the playoff race and played some really ugly games, giving up a lot of goals, not a lot of structure, despite some really talented players. So, you know, I think that definitely coupled with, as you were talking about, John Tavares' pending free agency and needing to give that give their own team a boost in that chase, and just try to take the team in a new direction. And who better to do it than a guy who's won three Stanley Cups and had the sort of legendary career that Lou Lamoriello has had.
Arthur, you've covered this team for a long time, and you've been on top of the John Tavares situation, if you want to call it that, better than anybody. And what can Lou Lamoriello do to maybe persuade John Tavares to sign a long-term deal with the Islanders?
You know, I think it's be Lou Lamoriello, be an aggressive executive. He's not a GM, but he's, as the statement the Islanders put out the other day said, he does have final say. over all their decisions. And, you know, in his previous two stops, he's never shied away from being aggressive, either on the trade market, the free agent market. And, you know, I think him coming into this organization that hasn't seen a lot of change, as you pointed out, Garth Snow has been here for 12 years. Mike Milbury was here for a long time before that, with not either of them having a lot of success. So, you know, I think kind of shaking that stagnant structure up with a guy like Lou Lamoriello, who's, you know, was never a very patient guy, and now that he's almost 76 years old, I can't imagine he's going to be patient now with his new job. So, you know, I think it's just a matter of showing John Tavares, who's seen some good things organizationally, like I said, with the new plan, new arena. Now he needs to see that they're committed to winning. And Lou Lamoriello has always been a guy who's done everything he can to win in the short term and in the long term.
Arthur, with the hiring of Lou Lamoriello, Garth Snow remains general manager, but should Snow be threatened that you know, his job might be in jeopardy?
Well, you know, he's going from him having final say in hockey decisions to that being taken away from him, in addition to one of his two titles. It's probably not a great feeling for him right now. He's still the GM. He does have a longstanding good relationship with Lamoriello, having both been executives in the league for a long time, and going back to when Snow was a player. They're both New Englanders, grew up pretty close to one another, and even though Lou's quite a bit older. So, you know, there's definitely mutual respect there. So I think it remains to be seen whether they can work together, whether Garth can accept being number two essentially right now, despite having the GM title, and whether Lou can work with someone who's used to having final say. You know, it's going to be interesting. I know they're having their organizational meetings right now this week, and I'm sure that Lamoriello jumped in today to get involved in that. And I'm certainly curious to see, because obviously, as we pointed out, it's a big off season for the Islanders, not just with Tavares. They've got to, whether he stays or goes, they've got to turn this thing around and become, you know, a perennial playoff team, as they seemed like they were close to doing a few years ago.
Arthur Staple, our guest on NHL This Week. Arthur is, of course, with The Athletic in New York City, covers the New York Islanders. Arthur, you've covered John Tavares for, you know, the entirety of his career. You know him as well as any writer knows anybody that they cover. What's going to be, from your perspective, sort of the determining factor as to where John Tavares goes on July 1st? We know that, you know, the dollars and cents are all going to be pretty comparable no matter where he signs. Long Island can give him that extra year, of course. But from your perspective, what's going to be the driving force for John Tavares?
Now, he says he wants to win, and that, even talking to people around him, that seems to be his motivating factor right now. You know, he wants to be on a team that that has a chance to win, that he fits into, that he's not, you know, starting from scratch again. I think there's definitely going to be some teams that are trying to figure out where they are in this chase that may not get out of the starting blocks just because he's not ready to hit the reset button. You know, obviously the Islanders aren't in any great shape, but with the way they've missed the playoffs the last 2 years, but he certainly came in with a very thin team, and they built it up. They did make the playoffs 3 times in 4 years. They did win around, mostly thanks to him. You know, I think what he's looking for is what he's always hoped to have here, which is, you know, a team that can contend every year. And that's a difficult thing to just drop a guy at 10 and a half or 11 million per year into. It's, you know, whatever team he goes to is going to be drastically altered just by adding him, in a good way, obviously, on the ice, but also, you know, cap structure wise and room wise. So, you know, I think when people started to dismiss the Islanders just because they haven't won very much, it's you know, I think he's being very cautious and he hasn't ruled anything out. And to me, he's been looking for reasons to stay. And that's part of the reason why he picked that meeting with Lou Lamoriello before this was all even official last week, that he wants to hear that Lamoriello is going to be aggressive and take this team and turn it in the right direction. And, you know, to my mind, that gives the Islanders as good a chance and maybe a better chance slightly than anybody else at this point, just because he's part of the team and he knows the terrain and he knows how great it would be to win here.
Arthur, we know that priority number one for Lou Lamoriello and Garth Snow is to sign John Tavares long-term, and we know that the Islanders are most likely going to go after a number one goaltender. They need to sign a number one goaltender. But I think you would agree that the Islanders are not one or two pieces away from being a Stanley Cup contender. Aside from bringing in a number one goaltender, what do you think another priority signing should be for the Islanders?
You know, I think a top four defenseman, preferably a left shot guy who can play, you know, first or second pair. They really, you know, you can't hang the most goals that team has given up in the last 10 years just on the guys on defense. But, you know, when Calvin DeHaan and Johnny Boychuk were lost for extended periods of time in December, they really had no cohesion in their own end. A guy like Nick Leddy, who they'd hoped would take a big step forward this year, ended up taking kind of a pretty serious step back those last 3 months of the season. You know, they got some good things from Ryan Pulock, who I think they're really enthused about and has emerged as a guy that they'd hoped would be, you know, a guy who's improved his skating and his positioning in the defensive zone to go with some pretty high-end offensive skills. So I think if you've got Leddy and you've got Pulock and you've got Johnny Boychuk coming off of surgery and getting a little bit older, you know, DeHaan is also coming off a pretty major shoulder operation. I don't know if he's going to stick around. So there's definitely a hole there for someone who could perhaps be a top pair guy or just a good minutes eater the way that DeHaan had rounded into. So, you know, I think something to stabilize their defense back there. They've certainly got guys who can put the puck in the net, whether Tavares stays or goes. You know, having a guy like Matthew Barzal at the top of your forward group, you know, solves a lot of issues, but really their commitment to playing without the puck and playing in their own end and playing on the penalty kill was pretty abysmal this year. So there's a lot of guys that are going to be back that have to look themselves in the mirror this summer and rededicate themselves. And Lou Lamoriello is going to go out and find a veteran or somebody to trade for on defense, or perhaps a free agent that's not necessarily a John Carlson type, maybe a second tier guy to eat some of those minutes on the second pair.
Arthur Staple, our guest on NHL This Week, we're talking about the New York Islanders. Arthur covers the team for TheAthletic.com in New York City. Arthur, the Islanders have two of the top 12 picks in this upcoming NHL draft, their own draft pick and the draft pick they acquired from the Calgary Flames in the Travis Hamonic deal. Drafting 11th and 12th, they could potentially use those picks to move up or to acquire somebody via trade. How do you see the Islanders proceeding in the NHL draft coming up this June?
Well, before Monday, I saw it one way, but I think that's kind of all. You know, you throw all those notes out now because, you know, I imagine Carl Snow has been a pretty patient guy at the draft. You know, he's gone into drafts without first round picks and come away with guys like Matthew Barzal in the years past. So he definitely sees the value of building up the prospect pool and being patient. I don't know how much patience they have left right now, though. And Lou Lamoriello, as we've talked about, is a guy who has some urgency. I think he's coming into a situation with a team that his mandate is to turn this team around and win now. So, you know, one or both of those picks could be up for sale. You know, you just think about his history in the last 5 years with his last two jobs. He traded a first-round pick to Vancouver for Corey Schneider when he was with the Devils to try to bridge that gap between Marty Brodeur and the next wave of Devils goaltending. And then in Toronto, one of his biggest moves was getting Freddie Anderson on the eve of the draft. So I think he certainly understands the priorities here. A goalie is paramount, perhaps another defenseman, and then they'll go from there. So, yeah, four picks in the first 43. You know, I think there was definitely lots of guys in that 11-12 range that could help them in the long term, but I don't know if they have if that's their timetable anymore.
Arthur, last question for you, and we appreciate your time on this Wednesday evening. Bill Torrey passed away earlier this month, and of course, Bill Torrey was the architect of the great New York Islanders dynasty. You know, how was his passing felt in Long Island? How was his passing felt in the entire organization? And just what did Bill Torrey mean to the New York Islanders for many of our audience who might be too young to remember him?
Well, just, You save the numbers of all the guys from the dynasty era for, you know, sometimes for these sad occasions. It's nice to see them around the rink sometimes. The Brian Trottier's and the Mike Bossies and the Bobby Nystrom's, they're there a lot. They're still heavily involved in the alumni network. But when you have to place that call to them to talk about something that's, you know, someone that meant so much to them, and we in the media down here did it a few years ago when Al Arbor passed away, and That was felt pretty strongly throughout the organization. And Bill Torrey is, he's a legend. He doesn't get a lot of the attention of the fanfare for those dynasty years that Al Arbor does. Obviously, he was more behind the scenes as a general manager back then, but he played no less an important role. And hearing some of the guys like Bob Bourne talk about, you know, budgetary concerns and how tough Torrey could be with them, even though he would play golf with them. And, you know, it was a very familial atmosphere. And that's something, you know, I think that gets a bit mocked these days. The Islanders are run a bit differently than some other teams in the past decades. Lower budget, a little bit leaner staff. And, it was very much that way in the dynasty era as well. They had plenty of budget concerns. Even the Coliseum was full year after year in those dynasty years. But there was always something going wrong at the ownership level with that team, and he really was able to keep that away from the players and keep them insulated and, for the most part, keep them happy. And that's a hard thing to do. And, you know, it was the pre-salary cap era, obviously a long time before that. So, but that's why we'll never see something like that again, just to, even without the monetary concerns, just keeping a group of large egos and successful athletes happy that like that for four and almost five straight years is something we'll never see again. And the way he was, put it together is second to none. And his loss was really felt very strongly down here.
Arthur Staple covers the New York Islanders for TheAthletic.com in New York City. Arthur, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll do it again real soon.
Thanks a lot, guys. Anytime.
Take care, Arthur. Thanks again. When we come back, Sarah McClellan of the Minneapolis Star Tribune is going to join us. The Minnesota Wild have a new general manager as well. His name is a familiar one to Jets fans. Paul Fenton, the new general manager in Minnesota. We'll talk to Sarah about that hire up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg in studio with you. This segment brought to you by Keener Jerseys, specializing in customization services and branded team apparel. Keener Jerseys is changing the game with world-class craftsmanship and unparalleled service. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want customized, visit KeenerJerseys.com or check out their showroom at 982 Portage Avenue. That's the corner of Portage and Sherburn. Tell them that Illegal Curve sent you.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Another segment, another team, another new general manager. His name is Paul Fenton. To discuss that hiring, we're pleased to be joined by Sarah McClellan of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Sarah, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Obviously, as I mentioned, the Minnesota Wild have a new general manager. Paul Fenton replaces Chuck Fletcher as the head man in Minnesota. Why now, Sarah, do you think that Paul Fenton took the opportunity to leave the Nashville Predators, where he's sort of been general manager in waiting for many a year now? Why now do you think he left the Predators to take the job with the Wild?
I think the timing was just right. I think he was ready. You know, I think he probably maximized and squeezed everything out of an assistant general manager role, obviously with his tenure with the Predators. You look at what that franchise has accomplished and getting to the final last year, finishing atop the league standings this year. I think Paul's handiwork was, a lot on that team's success and helping engineer, blockbuster trades and shrewd drafting and, making the right free agent acquisitions. I think he was very involved, obviously, in that process from his perch as assistant GM. And I think the fit was right, too, with the Wild. Obviously, he has familiarity with owner Craig Leopold. Leopold owned the Predators at the outset of that franchise's history. Obviously, Fenton came on board, so there was some paths crossed then. And I think they knew about each other and obviously had that rapport. And he comes over to a team in the Central Division, where he was with the Predators that he's familiar with. And so I think just the timing and the fit probably combined with the fact that, he's probably ready for this next challenge made this the right situation for Paul.
Now, Sarah, we know that Paul Fenton is highly qualified. assistant general manager for the Predators for many years, and we know that he has some players to sign. Matt Dumba is a pending RFA, but I think you'd agree that the Wild are probably going to have to bring in some more players to be competitive with the Jets and the Predators and some of the elite teams in the Western Conference. How do you see him remaking this roster?
Yeah, you know, I think probably an expectation from the outside is maybe that he'll make some type of splashy trade. I know he was asked about that yesterday, and you know, he said he has no expectations. I think he's just trying to get acclimated and get familiar and ready for the draft. But I think looking at the way that he's operated in Nashville, like we said, he wasn't afraid to pull the trigger on some bold, creative deals. PK Subban for Shea Weber, you know, Ryan Johansson for Seth Jones, just plain straight up hockey trades. And I think that's maybe what this roster is headed for. Obviously, this is a competitive team. It's been in the mix now, you know, making the playoffs 6 straight years. That's quite an accomplishment. But I think, you know, this is a team, a fan base, a community, a state of hockey that's hungry and thirsty for more than that. It's not just enough to make the playoffs. They want to win a round or two and win that elusive Stanley Cup. So I think it probably will be some maybe type of change that maybe changes a core piece of this roster and makes some type of substitution that way. A lot of pieces are under contract for next season, so really there doesn't have to be a lot of change. I think it is very discretionary, very up to, you know, someone's subjective view of how to tweak this roster, and that'll probably, you know, really be up to Paul and his staff to kind of, you know, make that stamp on it. You know, probably maybe add, bolster this offense. It was a team, obviously, that in that first round loss to Winnipeg closed out that series not scoring a goal for a couple games. It's a difficult challenge. So I'd look maybe to that regard for how he kind of maybe puts his first stamp on this team and roster.
Sarah McClellan, our guest on NHL This Week, we're discussing the Minnesota Wild hiring of Paul Fenton as new general manager. Sarah, what about the rest of his associates in the Wild front office? Is Paul Fenton expected to bring in his own sort of assistant general managers? What of the ones who were in existence under Chuck Fletcher, what's their future look like?
He said that he's not anticipating making any changes until he gets to know everyone. So I think he wants to get in, get familiar, start having conversations, and then assess kind of that step. But he was asked that at his arrival, and obviously that's something you wonder when someone new comes in, who he surrounds himself with. And it sounds like he's going to kind of take his time to do his homework and see the infrastructure here and then go from there.
Well, Sarah, we know Bruce Boudreau's coming back for at least one more year, but is it possible to know how much longer he's going to be the head coach? I guess a lot of it has to do with how far he takes the Wild in the playoffs next year.
Yeah, you know, that was something that was discussed, too, with Fenton's arrival, is just how him and Boudreau are going to kind of build a partnership and build a rapport. And talking to Fenton, it's a very much a priority for him, you know, to get to know Bruce. They've kind of crossed paths before. I think they played against each other in the past, in the minors, and obviously they've both been in NHL circles for a lot of years, but they don't really know each other. So I think that's probably a big project right now for Paul as he gets integrated, is figuring out Bruce and building that trust and, you know, kind of working with each other. And, you know, I think all signs yesterday pointed to him wanting to really forge a strong partnership with Bruce. And he also made it clear Bruce is going to coach and Paul is going to manage. Paul says he's kind of, you know, not a coach, never been a coach, not going to dip his toe into that situation. So it sounds like, you know, there is a partnership that's in the process of being built between those two.
Sarah, was Paul Fenton always Craig Leopold's man, or was anybody else close to being hired as GM of the Wild?
He said, Craig, that this was his number one kind of choice on the top of his list, and he kind of never wavered. Obviously, the Wild did consider numerous candidates. You know, I think when Craig Leopold started this process, he said he wrote down 5 names just right off the bat. But Paul was number one, and he said he kind of never wavered from that position. I think there was the familiarity there, that factor, obviously, but just the fact that I think Paul's resume was probably pretty strong in terms of the experience and just someone being ready for that next step. But it was a pretty extensive process. You know, this took about a month. There was a second round of interviews. I think it kind of came down to Tom Fitzgerald out of New Jersey and Paul Fenton. It appeared to be those two were kind of in the final running. So they definitely did their due diligence, but I think this was kind of, you know, the front runner from the get-go and, you know, the candidate they had in mind, and it obviously finalized that way.
Sarah McClellan, our guest on NHL This Week, discussing the Minnesota Wild hiring of Paul Fenton as their new general manager. Sarah, sort of as an addendum to Ezra's question, you know, Craig Leopold obviously familiar with Paul Fenton from his time as owner of the Predators, where Fenton, of course, was assistant general manager for so long. Was that familiarity maybe a bit of a tipping factor in Fenton's direction?
Yeah, I think it definitely helped. You know, I think that was being on Craig Leopold's radar, kind of knowing about him. You know, he drafted Ryan Suter. Ryan Suter's obviously, you know, part of this organization too. So there were some ties there. But, you know, I still think this was a vetted process. You know, the team president of the Wild was also involved in the interviews. And I think kind of Craig put in there kind of a key knowledge, maybe as a checks and balances, and to make sure that everyone was, you know, vetted correctly and, you know, kind of given the same fair evaluation. But I think that familiarity probably did play a role in the fact that it was someone he knew, someone he already kind of had a rapport with. And then you look at what he has accomplished. And, you know, obviously Craig was involved in the national organization when a lot of that, you know, started rolling. And he started making these types of key draft picks. And Pecorino gets added to the mix. And you just kind of see the body of work. You know, I definitely think that was probably helpful in this process for Paul.
Sarah, we mentioned Matt Dumba earlier, and he's coming off of a career year, obviously, for the Wild. Do you expect that contract to get done fairly soon?
I wouldn't say probably imminently, because I think there's probably just so much on Paul's plate right now in terms of getting acclimated and the draft is looming. But, you know, I think it has to be a headlining priority just because there aren't very many players that are up for new contracts this year on the Wild. It's him, Jason Zucker, the other kind of RFA who was a regular with the team. And, you know, there's a couple of UFAs. So it's just those are the two big names. So I'd expect him to be top of the list. But in terms of kind of, you know, how soon, I know the combine is next week. Paul Fenton will be there. He comes back here after that to the Twin Cities, and there's amateur and pro meetings. So, I'm sure the homework will get started in that time frame, but I think this is kind of going to be a whirlwind transition, and, you know, maybe we don't see that a little later on in the offseason.
Sarah McClellan covers the Minnesota Wild for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. She's a good friend of this program. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us this evening. We'll let you get back to enjoying Game 7 between the Capitals and the Lightning.
You guys too. Have a good night.
Take care, Sarah. When we come back, that's our topic of conversation. It's been a spirited first period, to put it mildly, a great fight just a second ago between Braden Coburn and Tom Wilson. We talk about Game 7. We talk about the Caps and the Lightning up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
To the blue line, and back down the wall. In front, oh, she scores! T.J. Oshie from between the dots! 4:48 to go, second period! Sing it with me, it's 1-0! Ooh, Washington!
Capitals won Game 6 on the heels of that T.J. Oshie goal to force a Game 7 in the Eastern Conference Final. That Game 7 has 4 minutes to go in the first period. Washington Capitals leading 1-0. Alex Ovechkin gets the goal a minute into the game. They currently have a 1-0 lead on the Tampa Bay Lightning. The winner gets to meet the Vegas Golden Knights for the Stanley Cup. If it's Tampa, it starts Monday night in Tampa. If it's the Capitals, it starts Monday night in Vegas. A lot on the line. Alex Ovechkin.
You know who Golden Knights fans are cheering for right now?
I would assume that they're cheering for Washington?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I also think
you want to start the Stanley Cup Final at home, don't you?
I would think you would. I would definitely.
Especially with how well they played all year long.
Yeah.
In Vegas.
Alex Ovechkin.
T-Mobile.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, Alex Ovechkin has been a man possessed, you know, before this game, before game six as well, referring it to these games as the most important games in his career.
Drew, what about this? Right before we went to break last segment,
yeah,
you mentioned Braden Coburn and Tom Wilson chuck the knuckles.
They didn't just
great
chuck
fight.
Them. Great fight. I mean,
that's a big boy fight.
Yeah.
Braden Coburn's a big boy. I mean, Tom Wilson's not a small guy, but Braden Coburn's bigger. He's 6'5",
yeah,
220 pounds.
And Tom Wilson's isn't as big, but
he's tough as nails.
He hits everything.
What about this?
Uh-huh.
They literally just got out of the penalty box. Both players
were serving
unsportsmanlike conduct penalties.
Yeah.
They get out of the box. 3 or 4 seconds later, they drop the gloves. And what about this? This is the second game in a row there has been a fight in the first period, because last game, Brooks Orpik and JT Miller dropped the gloves, and that was, coincidentally enough, both at the 15-minute mark of the first period.
Apparently the 15-minute
mark... Not exactly,
yeah,
but...
Close enough. Yeah. Apparently that you know, 15 minutes into the game is where both teams have decided they really hate each other again. You know, the Capitals, you know, you sort of saw, I don't know if you saw the highlights earlier today, as Barry Trotz did the hot lap for the Capitals.
That was awesome.
In the morning skate. The Capitals seem very loose, because they don't really have what I'll describe as a ton of pressure on them. They're playing in Tampa, much like the Jets were playing in Nashville.
There's more pressure on the Lightning, because all of the pressure in Game 6 was on Washington
to win,
playing
at home,
on home ice, forcing a Game 7, and Tampa Bay came out flat, and they were badly outplayed.
Yeah. It took until...
Especially in the second period.
It took until, you know, 5 minutes to go in the second period before they were finally able to get a goal past Vasilevsky. Watching that game, I don't know if you watched Game 6, Ezzy, but you sort of felt watching that game that if Tampa was going to get that first goal, it was just going to be demoralizing to the Capitals because of how dominant they were in terms of game flow and everything else.
That top line has to step up. Steven Stamkos, Nikita Kucherov, Andrei Palat. Because they weren't good in Game 6.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven Stamkos has 0 career points in 3 career Game 7s?
Well, I mean, whatever the...
Or 4 career Game 7s? I forget what it is, but he has not been good in Game 7s.
The number that... The operative number, the key number there, is 0 career points in Game 7.
Yeah.
I mean, you need your best players in this instance right now to step up and be your best players. Ovechkin, as I mentioned, opened the scoring a minute into the game. TJ Oshie gets the goal in Game 6. I think Kuznetsov had a goal in Game 6. I think he had the second goal. So the best players on the Capitals are stepping up. The question is, can the best players on the Lightning step up and be able to tie this game and eventually, you know, win it for them to send them to a Stanley Cup, to the Stanley Cup against the Golden Knights?
And Stamkos has been good in the series. He's got 3 goals and 6 points in this series, but he doesn't have any points the last 2 games. And this game tonight is early. It's, you know, a minute left in the first period here as we're live on air. But, I mean, Stamkos and Kucherov especially have to step up because they haven't been good the last couple games.
No, they won Game 5. And then, you know, Game 6, they really didn't step up. The Capitals, a team that's notorious for losing Game 6s, especially on home ice, and having minimal, if you know, really minimal success is even complimentary to just how little success they typically have in Game 7s. Right now, look like the looser team. They look like they have more jump to the start of this game. I mean, I mentioned Barry Trotz. They look like they're having fun. They had no expectations, really, on them entering these playoffs.
And they know that they can do it because they were down 2-0 to Columbus
right
in the first round.
Well, they were up 2-0 in this series. Tampa came back, won the next 3 games to take a 3-2 lead, and then it sort of like jolted the Capitals back into reality, and they stepped up in that Game 6.
And they've been good all playoffs on the road.
They have
right?
been. I mean, this is it's pretty much the same team, you know, that, you know, has choked in the playoffs for so many consecutive years. That this year, when they didn't really have any pressure on them, sure, they won the Metropolitan Division, but nobody thought the Capitals were really an overwhelming Stanley Cup contender. Nobody talked about them as one of the favorites to come out of the East, despite their
regular
season. Maybe
they should have been.
Well, I mean, I think I understand why people didn't say it. They said...
They still won the division.
I know, but they said...
It's not like they had a bad regular season.
No, but they said, yeah, you win a division. You win a division every year, and then you choke in either the first or the second round. This year, they didn't do that. This year, they beat the Blue Jackets after losing the first 2 games. This year, they beat the Penguins. They finally got over the Penguins, and depending on what happens over the final, you know, 40 minutes plus 20 seconds in this game, you know, maybe they get over the Tampa Bay Lightning, and all of a sudden Alex Ovechkin is playing for the Stanley Cup. And like, as you mentioned off air to me, they're finally going to have you'd have a first-time Stanley Cup winner. Steven Stamkos, I mean, can you imagine if he loses in this Game 7? You mentioned how he's had a lack of success individually in Game 7s. Well, he hasn't won a Stanley Cup yet. This would probably be his best opportunity. He's not getting any younger. I mean, the Lightning are still going to be a very good team for years to come, especially with an infusion of talent like they have with a guy like Braden Point. But the Lightning have to be sitting here saying, well, this is a prime opportunity. We were up 3-2, Game 7 on home ice. You know, it would be a fascinating Stanley Cup final, whichever team is going
to
win it.
I agree. And if Washington does win tonight, Drew,
yeah,
and go on to the Stanley Cup final, I think the player that you have to feel the best for, I mean, we're going to feel great for Barry Trotz, of course, because he's from Manitoba.
Yeah.
But you have to feel great for Braden Holtby because he started the playoffs as a backup goaltender.
Yeah.
Philip Grubauer started the first two games
Holtby
against Columbus. And even though Andre Vasilevsky has been phenomenal all playoffs long, mm-hmm, and especially in these playoffs, I mean, Vasilevsky's numbers have been great,
yeah,
in the Eastern Conference Final, but Braden Holtby has been equally as good, and he obviously hasn't let in a goal yet tonight. It's only one period. But for me, you know, Braden Holtby, that's such a great story.
I got to tell you, the person I'd be happiest for is Alex Ovechkin. I mean, it changes the narrative on his career just by making it to a Stanley Cup final. I mean, you know, when Joe Thornton made it to the Stanley Cup final with San Jose a few years back when they lost to the Pittsburgh Penguins, it just changed the discussion that you have about a guy like Thornton.
Because I think both of those players would have been Hall of Famers
of
without going to the Stanley Cup final.
Of course, but at least...
I think you hope that he wins it.
Yes.
I mean, you don't want to just go to the Stanley Cup final. If you're Ovechkin, you've waited your entire career. He's 32 years old. He's not going to be happy just to be there. He wants to win.
Of course he's not. He definitely wants to win, but getting there does change the tenor of the conversation, at least to some extent. Because, you know, if you say about a player that he never made it to a Stanley Cup final... I mean, never winning one. Well, there's only, you know, one team a year that wins one. You know, getting to one is an accomplishment. It's not the holy grail of accomplishments, yeah, but it is an accomplishment.
I agree.
I should make mention, of course, that this segment of the program, this final segment of the program, is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For a list of performers and showtimes, please visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Remember, if you're looking to maybe try your hand as a stand-up comedian, Winnipeg's funniest person with a day job, applications, entrance information, that's now available. So if you think you have what it takes, as you did stand-up comedy once, maybe twice.
Yeah, I don't think I was that funny.
You weren't that funny, but I still love you anyways. You know, you can enter to be Winnipeg's funniest person with a day job. All the information and a list of upcoming performances and showtimes and everything else available on the website, rumorscomedyclub.com.
No, Drew, we talked about Barry Trotz and Alex Ovechkin and Braden Holtby. I mean, Barry Trotz has waited his entire NHL head coaching career to go to the Stanley Cup final because you remember, he didn't get past the second round when he was head coach of the Nashville Predators. But what about Nicklas Backstrom? He's been a member of the Capitals since 2007.
Sure.
Drafted fourth overall back in 2006. He's waited his entire career for this. So there are a lot of players on the Washington Capitals who have been waiting a long time to go to the Stanley Cup final. Again, you know, it's not over yet. It's only one period. The Caps are up 1-0, and the
it's
Lightning
start,
are going
to
make a game of this. Yeah. But, I mean, this Capitals team, as you said, they haven't had as much pressure on them as maybe they did last year and the year before when they were winning the President's Trophy. But, wow, they've waited a long time for this.
They certainly have waited a long time. I mean, Barry Trotz, the amazing part is, of course, he's still not under contract for next year. I mean, who knows? Getting to the conference final, you have to assume this gets, you know, the job done and getting a contract. But you wonder.
I would say so.
You wonder if there's more, if there's something else bubbling underneath the surface between him and Brian McClellan. And that's potentially part of the reason why it hasn't gotten done yet. I don't know. I'm just speculating here. I have no idea if there is animosity between the two of them. But certainly Trotz has done enough in these Stanley Cup finals or in these Stanley Cup playoffs.
I mean, what more could he do? The Capitals won the division.
Yeah.
The Metro division is, I think, the second best division in the league after the Central.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're two periods away from going to the Stanley Cup final.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the ultimate goal, as you said, Drew, is winning the Stanley Cup. But I think Trotz has done a pretty good job there.
I would agree with you there. That's it for this Wednesday edition of NHL This Week. It's the season finale of NHL This Week, so we want to thank everyone who's with us all season long. Saturday's Illegal Curve Hockey Show. That's not going anywhere. We'll still be with you at 9 a.m. on Saturday. But this is it for the NHL this week until the fall, of course, when the season
shout out
starts
to producer
again.
Chris and producer Rory, and big shout out to Sean Asor.
Yes, Sean Asor unfortunately wasn't able to join us today, but he was with us all season long, so big thanks to them. And producer Chris Curry and producer Rory McGoran doing a great job in making us sound so good. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. In case you missed any of the program, it's available on our website, illegalcurve.com. You can also subscribe wherever you get your podcast, get it sent to you each and every week. Big thanks to my colleague Ezra Gensburg. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. This has been NHL This Week live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.